Last time here, on behalf of my client, the city of North Richland Hills. Many years ago, I was a law clerk in one of the first civil opinions or civil cases I worked on. The appellant submitted 22 points of error or points or issues. And at that point, I decided that I made a promise to myself that if I ever had the privilege to practice civil appellate law, I would only submit if ever, 5 issues, maybe 6, and I would never go over 35 pages. The brief I've submitted to the court exceeds that, and I apologize. But some housekeeping issues. As noted in our reply brief, or in my reply brief, essentially we agree now on issue 4, and if Mr. Anderson gets up and says that he still agrees with me on issue 4, the court doesn't really have to address that. The same with respect to damages under Article 1, Section 19 of the Texas Constitution. There's no private right of action for damages. If Mr. Anderson still agrees with me on that, you don't have to address Issue 6. That gets us down to 5 issues. One more thing. Issues 1 and 2 both concern governmental immunity with respect to breach of contract claims. I believe that if the court sustains issue 1, it doesn't have to reach issue 2, and vice versa. It's down to 4 issues. That's very manageable. Look how reasonable I can be. I will assume the court is, of course, familiar with the facts. And today I will focus, unless the court pulls me elsewhere, I'll focus on the second and third issues in the brief. The first issue is concerns, of course, the statutory waiver of immunity for breach of contract claims. Our position is that under the agreement, under the facts that have been alleged, there's absolutely nothing that could be due and owing to Arcadia or to appellees generally under this development agreement. Section 271.123 of the Local Government Code limits awards under that chapter. Even assuming it's a contract for providing goods or services to the local government, only balances due and owed to the, or excuse me, by the local government entity under the contract. It also allows recovery for amounts owed for change orders or additional work. There are a couple of other things that aren't really applicable here. The very first Supreme Court case, right after this statute was put in the books, the Supreme Court addressed the applicability because it was applied retroactively. In Took versus the City of Mejia, the city essentially was in a contract with a man for brush pickup services. Apparently, obviously, goods or services. They had a jury trial. The jury awarded lost profits. That's not recoverable under 153. The Supreme Court said, well, since you can't get lost profits under 271.153, there's no waiver of immunity, and it's dismissed. Very clearly, the Supreme Court was holding that the issue of whether damages falls under 271.153 is jurisdictional. It is part of the waiver of immunity, and if you don't satisfy it, you're kicked out of court. Perhaps recognizing this, the appellees tried to distinguish Took, I think reasonably tried to distinguish Took, on the fact that it was an appeal from a jury verdict. Essentially, by the time the Supreme Court was looking at this case, they already knew exactly what types of damages had been awarded. They could say they were, lost profits, clearly consequentials, not allowed under the statute, goodbye. But they extrapolate some other cases for the proposition that essentially what that means is we can't get to this issue unless we have a jury verdict. And you can't get to this damages issue until we consider the merits first. The cases they cite don't say that at all.
But aren't they really just saying that, not that you can never get to the merits, merits, but just in this case you can't because at a minimum there's a genuine issue of material fact.
Well, Your Honor, again, that's Justice Walker, that is not what we're saying here. What we're saying is if you look at what we want you to assume the facts of everything they have pled, everything. We want you to reasonably construe everything in that development agreement in their favor. And lastly, if the court wants to, and I think it should, assume that we breached that development agreement when we did not place the rec center where it was supposed to go inside the development. It was placed across the street, but assume it was placed across town. In that instance, what do we owe them under the agreement? Nothing. They get to keep the property. They can build stuff on it. They can grow stuff on it. They can sell it to somebody else to build or grow on. The lease, they're required to lease us space for parking. They don't have to lease anything to us. Essentially, they get to retain the property. And that's specifically set forth in the provisions of the agreement. There are duplicative clerk's records in this case because it's consolidated appeal, but in the hometown clerk's record at 116, this is, I believe, page 6 or 7 of the development agreement. Essentially, it says, any instrument conveying a tract for the rec center to the city shall contain a right of reverter to the effect that if the city does not commence construction of the city recreation center as soon as practicable after the conditions set forth herein have been met, ownership of such tract shall revert to the party from whom such conveyance is made.
What section is that in the agreement?
I'm sorry, that's page 14, Your Honor. And I'm reading from, it's page 15. It's toward the center of the page.
Okay.
That is a page without paragraphs.
Okay.
I would say that it's a quarter down the page.
Thank you.
Okay. If you read the entire run-on 2.5 page paragraph, it starts off with, if certain conditions were met, the developer or whoever owned that property at the time was going to convey it to the city. The city, within a reasonable time, needed to commence construction, and once they commenced it, they needed to follow through till completion. Now, clearly, the agreement contemplates the fact that at some point, if the city wanted to, it could just throw up its hands and say, look, we don't want the rec center here, we want it someplace else. And in fact, that's what happened here. They felt like they needed more space, more parking, more square footage, so they moved it across the street, well, a couple hundred yards away. So essentially, what we're saying here is, in contrast to the cases that they've cited, all of them assume, for example, in the Kirby Lake case, in that case, the Water Authority had entered into a contract with the developer was going to install certain public infrastructure, and then the Water Authority said, hey, we'll rent that from you, and if we ever get these bonds approved, we'll purchase it outright. Well, the Water Authority took the position that, well, we just had to submit it to the voters once, and if it didn't pass, we don't ever have to submit it to the voters again. We get to rent it forever. We never have to buy it. In that case, they argued, the authority argued, the government argued, that there's nothing due and owing under this contract because there's been no bonds that have been approved. No bonds have been approved. Therefore, there's no, the condition precedent for us to pay you has not been satisfied. Therefore, there's nothing due and owing. 271-153, we're immune. You should let us out. Supreme Court very appropriately said, no, you're assuming the merits. I mean, the whole issue in the case was, did the Water Authority have to keep submitting the bond issue in successive elections? And the Water Authority was, well, we don't owe you anything because the bond hasn't been approved. Well, that was the central issue in the case. This case, very different. Assume everything in their favor. Look at the contract. What do they get? They get to keep their property. We get to go build our rec center across the street. Given that there's nothing due and owed under the contract for this particular breach, or the only breach they're alleging, I believe it's appropriate and the trial court should have sustained our plea of the jurisdiction. And
why would that not be an MSJ?
Well, Your Honor,
I
think very well it could be. But as the court is well aware, it's perfectly appropriate for us to submit a plea to the jurisdiction based solely on the pleadings, which is what the city did in this instance. In other words, we want you to, just like there's a summary judgment, motion for judgment on the pleadings, essentially, and that's essentially what we did in this case.
Is the city not disputing that Kirby Lake resolves the issue of whether there were goods or services provided?
That is a very good question, Your Honor. And I could spend an inordinate amount of time discussing it. But essentially, I think our position is no, it doesn't resolve. I mean, if you read very carefully, and again, this was a consolidation of many different appellate court opinions, appellate cases. The Friendswood 1 Court of Appeals case from Houston essentially said this, and the facts are pretty much very similar. The Court of Appeals said, okay, the conveyance of the facilities to the water authority after the pipes had been put in the ground, that's not goods. They're fixtures. That's not goods or services. That's essentially our theory under Issue 1, okay? Now, when it goes up to the Supreme Court says, we agree with the Court of Appeals. Now, why did the Friendswood 1 Court of Appeals essentially refuse to apply immunity? Well, that's because they said, well, there's this little provision in that contract that says that the developer had to go out and hire third parties to essentially install these facilities. We think those are services, and, you know, that's enough. It's providing goods or services to the authority. Therefore, that waiver of immunity applies. Now, when we get to now, we can factually distinguish this case. There is a provision in our development agreement, and we'll give you the page number if you ask. It essentially says you can go out and you can hire third parties if you want to, but you don't have to. That is how I factually distinguish this case. Now, if you look at the...
then you're making the providing of services be on whether or not they are required to hire someone or they only may hire someone. That's your position?
That is our position, Your Honor.
Wouldn't that require rewriting the statute because it doesn't say that?
Well, Your Honor, I'll be quite honest with you. If we narrow that goods or if we expand that goods or services language anymore, it's going to swallow everything. Okay, that limitation needs to mean something. I mean, for crying out loud, can you? Think of a simple real estate contract. You know, I come to a closing and or you know, I'm going to convey something, city property to, convey property to the city. In the contract for sale, it says you need to go get title insurance. Well, is that services? I mean, it's not the main thrust of the contract, certainly, but it's some services. You have to go and you have to get the title insurance and you have to bring it to closing. And so the limitation of goods or services in that statute, it needs to mean something.
And we're supposed to construe waiver language narrowly.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I will note that there is some loose language in the Kirby Lake case that essentially uses the term broad or... But what they're talking about is how they liberally construed the insurance services contract in the Ben Bolt case. They're not talking about the language in the statute. And I understand that some of the Kirby Lake language is a little broad, but I think the court should look at, they're responding to a certain argument. At the Supreme Court, the Water Authority was not making the argument that this is goods and services, this isn't. They were making the,
Go ahead and finish your sentence.
They weren't parsing between what's goods or what's services. At the Supreme Court level, the Water Authority was arguing, and this is on page 34 to 38 of their brief before the Supreme Court, if you would like me to provide the court copies. Essentially, they were arguing, no, you're not providing those goods and services to the authority. Essentially, when you're putting those pipes in the ground of the development, that's providing services to the eventual residents of the development, not to the authority. And so when you read the language in Kirby Lake, I think you need to read it in context of what the Water Authority was arguing. And unless the court has any questions, I will sit down for the time being.
Okay, thank you, Counsel. Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Your Honor. Art Anderson representing the appellees. It's kind of hard to respond because he had six issues, it got to one. So I'll try my best to kind of focus on the Kirby Lake issue and the breach of contract.
Why don't you start out by saying if you agree with his representation?
I was just about to do that. We do agree, Your Honor, as to his issue four, that the attorney's fees related to the declaratory judgment claim for breach of contract, you have to actually have a specific provision in the contract that says that attorney's fees are recoverable under the statute. Since this was done well in advance of those, we cannot recover attorney's fees for breach of contract, so we agree. And the same thing on the constitutional violation. Specifically, it's a due process violation for not providing notice to the property owners of the zoning change. We cannot recover compensation for that constitutional breach. We can recover basically the ability to have that action revoked, but not monetary damages. So we agree.
Six.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
To kind of flesh out the facts a little bit, it's kind of hard, and if I was smart, I would have had a map up here to show you that I could work off of to visualize this. But the hometown development is even more, I guess, an example of where the provisions to waive immunity in 271 should apply compared to Kirby Lake. And then there's two cases that are related to that, the MCR case and a Clear Lake Water Authority case. In this sense, the developer and the city were almost like partners when this development started in 1999. And there were different components. One was there was a regulatory plan as part of the zoning that was adopted, basically showing where all the uses were going to be and what kind of densities, a typical type of concept plan as part of the zoning. There was a plat, and it showed where the recreation center is going to be and how it fits in with the overall development. Then there was this development agreement. Then there was a tax increment financing zone as part of the development agreement that was created. And so basically the dollars that were collected as a result of our clients developing the property were put into a fund to use for city improvements, one of which is a city library, which is located within hometown. So basically the relationship between the two is significant. And there are, I think I've listed in our brief, basically three full pages of providing goods and services to the city by our client. So I think it's extremely clear in this particular case that this particular agreement is covered under Chapter 271. On the amounts due and owing, all of the cases that we could find and that are cited in our brief all state that that does not go to the jurisdictional issue. It is more appropriate for a motion for summary judgment or some other dispositive motion, but not as to the plea to the jurisdiction. I would like to point out that one step beyond that, one of the ways that we're damaged, and we've alleged this in our petition, we briefed it, is that there are consequential damages that we recognize we cannot recover as a result, and they didn't move it just across the street, by the way. By moving it outside of hometown, there are damages that we suffer as a result of that because of the traffic that was to come in to frequent the retail portion of our development that we can't recover under 271 because the statute does not allow it, and we recognize that. Now, we have inverse condemnation claims and other claims, but we recognize that we cannot recover those damages there. However, one of the important parts of keeping the recreation center where it is that we were going to have joint parking with the rec center. And this is because it's a new urbanism development where basically there's going to be a lot of walking and pedestrian and trails, and basically we want people to park and then be able to frequent either the governmental facilities, the retail, or if they're multifamily, they can park there for their residences. As part of the agreement, we were to provide the land for 400 parking spaces, and the city was supposed to construct 400 parking spaces, which the rec center could use and we could use as part of our development. We believe that, you know, separate and aside from the jurisdictional part as to whether or not it's appropriate at this point in the case for them to bring up that issue or whether it should be as part of an MSJ, we have alleged, and it's in our petition in our briefing, that there are amounts that are due and owing to us as a result of the breach.
What's your best case for saying that the damages or the lack of damages is not jurisdictional? The whole damage issue is not jurisdictional.
There are a couple of cases. One is the City of Mesquite. Yeah, I think there are several. The Mejia case, I think, is clearly distinguishable. That's before Kirby Lake, and Mr. Quast is correct. That case actually went to trial. So that was a case that did get disposed of on its merits, was not a plea to the jurisdiction case. I apologize. It's the City of Mesquite. I can't remember, Your Honor, if it's PKG Contracting has the specific language in there. And as well, there's a Dart versus Monroe case that actually was a real estate transaction that did not close. It's kind of similar to what Mr. Quast talked about. It did not close. And Dart argued this is real property, so therefore it doesn't fall within the goods and services portion of the statute. And the Court of Appeals said, yes, it does, because it involves more than just the conveyance of real estate. It also had some requirements as to how Monroe could develop his property later. And basically that case provides he gets damages because Dart refused to close on the real estate contract, which I think kind of fits within what Mr. Quast is saying. I would like to cite to two cases, Your Honors, and I apologize that are not in my brief, dealing with the Declaratory Judgment Act issue. One is Texas Lottery Commission case. This is from the Supreme Court. The site is 2010 WL 3818297, and this was handed down this month, October 1. And what happened in that case was there's been an ongoing difference of opinion among courts of appeals regarding this issue of whether or not the Declaratory Judgment Act waives immunity when you're talking about cities and municipal ordinances. There is a provision if you ask for a statute to be declared void or an ordinance that a city is required to be a party. That's in 37.06A, I think, or 04A. We are requesting that relief when it comes to the city's SUP ordinance that was adopted without our notice. So, for example, the city is required under the Declaratory Judgment Act to be a party to that. And there's lots of cases that say immunity is clearly waived because of the fact that you have to have them as a party. There's a difference of opinion among some courts of appeals on the issue of if the question is construction of an ordinance, not to declare it invalid as to whether immunity is waived. And we believe the Texas Lottery case, while it deals with a statute instead of an ordinance, stands four square for that proposition. It goes back to a case called the Leaper case, where basically the Supreme Court says if the issue is the construction of a statute in this case, then the Declaratory Judgment Act waives immunity. The second case, and this actually was handed down by this court earlier this year, and I did mention in my brief, I apologize, it's the City of Crowley versus Ray. It was handed down in March 2010, Westlaw 1006278. And in that case, the Ray was asking the court to construe the language of certain floodplain documents. They weren't even all ordinances. They were just floodplain maps. And the City of Crowley said that there was no immunity there. So there's kind of two issues. One is the city an appropriate party? In other words, he was not asking for these maps to be declared void or invalid. He just wanted to have a construction. So that was one. This Fort Worth Court of Appeals said yes. The second part was, well, what kind of documents are covered by the Declaratory Judgment Act? Because there's a list. There's ordinances and statutes and wills and deeds and contracts and things like that. And this one was maps, and this court again said, yes, that's covered. That list is not exclusive, and that these documents also can be construed, which from how I see it means that that's a fairly, I guess, broad view in terms of the Declaratory Judgment Act waiving immunity in that situation. The issue of the zoning notice, very briefly, and I know Mr. Quast didn't reach that, but we have cited case, and I think the primary one is Bolton versus Sparks. It's a Supreme Court case of 62 that basically says that notice, providing notice in accordance with Chapter 211 of the Local Government Code is jurisdictional. And if the notice is not provided so that the people who are affected don't have the ability to find out how it's being affected and to attend the Planning and Zoning Commission in the City Council meeting, then that particular action by the city is ineffective and void because it doesn't meet the jurisdictional requirements. And I apologize for this, too, because it's not my brief, but seeing Justice Gabriel, who I don't think I've seen in 17 years, there's a case that she handled that went up to the Court of Appeals. It was East Justin Joint Venture versus City of Northlake, which actually was an annexation case that had the quo warranto aspect as part of that. And this Court of Appeals actually ruled in that case that even if it was procedural, the way these quo warranto cases usually go is it just a procedural defect, okay, as opposed to a substantive defect, that if the procedure is basically critical and jurisdictional as to the action, then that too is void. And in that case, quo warranto action was authorized in that particular case. I don't think that quo warranto applies here at all. That's an annexation issue. And I will freely admit there's one case that Mr. Quast pointed out that I'd never heard of, which in my opinion is out in left field, and it was a no petition case called the City of Midland versus Walton case. It's the only one I've seen. And I think if you look at the Declaratory Judgment Act, it's pretty clear because it talks about cities have to be necessary parties if an ordinance is to be declared invalid. Well, if that's true, then there has to be standing for the person who's going to file suit under the Declaratory Judgment Act under that provision in order to find it to be invalid. The last item concerns the inverse condemnation claim. Very, very briefly, I think Mr. Quast is saying that we are trying to recast our contract claim as an inverse claim, inverse condemnation claim, Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution. We are not. And I think I've made that clear, but in our briefing and in the petition, we're arguing our inverse condemnation claim under the Sheffield versus Glenn Heights case by the Supreme Court. Supreme Court follows the requirements of the Penn Central case of the U.S. Supreme Court. And basically, the Texas Supreme Court said that there can be a myriad of factors that can justify or substantiate the investment-backed expectations of the developer or the landowner. And if those are deprived, then he can be entitled to compensation as a result of that. What we are arguing is there's a plat, there's zoning. 70% of Hometown's been developed in accordance with the development agreement and the zoning that was in place before this SUP provision was put in. So we have preliminary plats, we have regulating plans, we have dedicated and built millions of dollars of infrastructure and given it to the city. We've assisted in the creation of a tax increment financing district, which served as the funding for the library. The city's gone out, and we not only did we have a place for the recreation center, it was shown on an approved preliminary plat, an approved zoning plan, the approved master plan of the city. The development agreement has an as an exhibit. So it's not just the development agreement that we're saying helps to serve as part of our investment back to expectations. There are numerous city documents and approvals that basically serve as part of that. So I agree with Mr. Quast. If we were simply recasting a breach of contract claim as an inverse claim, we should not be allowed to do that, but that's not what we're doing. We're saying that the development agreement is basically one factor, and that's what the cases say in these investment-backed expectations cases, is you have to look at all of the factors and balance it out and see if there was a reasonable investment-backed expectation to develop in accordance with the ordinances and agreements in effect at that time. Thank you. We would request that you uphold the two trial court judges who denied the city's plea to the jurisdiction. Thank you.
That is precisely correct, Your Honor. The way I read their pleadings, and the way I believe the court should read their pleadings, is they have essentially alleged three types of takings claims. The first one is, like he said, the Penn Central Sheffield development type of factor-based analysis that essentially says you failed or you rezoned my property to take multifamily uses away. You didn't grant me an SUP. I don't get multifamily uses. That lowers the value of my property. So we have to weigh a number of factors. The three main ones are, you know, oft quoted, but it's actually a factual ad hoc based decision. In other words, I am regulating your property in a manner that that diminishes its value. And if that is his claim, can the circumstances surrounding the adoption of the development agreement and what was in the development agreement and what was promised in the development agreement, can that be relevant evidence? Absolutely. We have no disagreements there. The other takings claim is essentially they're saying that NRH2O is using some of the parking that's on property that belongs to Arcadia. That's more of a physical taking. I will concede that is a valid allegation. Now, what we don't concede is a valid allegation is the allegation that, well, under the terms of the development agreement, you promised to put the recreation center right there. And when you put it somewhere else, or you're planning to put it somewhere else, you were diminishing the value of my property because I'm not going to get as much traffic and it's going to diminish the value of the retail. The distinction is this. Where did they get their rights to have the recreation center go right there? They got it from, is it from property rights? Is it from property laws? From the Texas Constitution? No. They got that from the development agreement. So the distinction here is I don't disagree that they can use the development agreement as some evidence in their Penn Central case. But what I don't concede is they can allege that as some separate takings claim. And that's what I'm asking the court to clarify. Oh, goodness. With respect to I apologize to the court. I have not read the Texas Lottery decision. With the court's permission, I'd like to review it. But I have also cited a recent Texas Supreme Court case. It's a per curiam case that essentially says if you're asking a public official to interpret a statute or ordinance and they give you an answer you don't like and you want to go to a court to construe that ordinance, you have to join the public official in their official capacity. That is Texas Reconveyance Services versus the Texas Insurance Department. It is cited in my brief. With respect to the Crowley case, my firm handled that case. It's easily distinguishable. They're talking about all these documents. We're talking about a stormwater ordinance. Stormwater ordinance, part of the ordinance is the maps. And that's what the issue was. So they were construing an ordinance in that case. And I think that case was that case did not have the benefit of the more recent authority that I've cited. Bolton versus Sparks concerning the notice issue that predates Alexander Oil Company versus City of Seguin, which clearly or implicitly overruled that case. With respect to the position that the procedural voidable dichotomy only applies in annexation cases, I need someone to tell me why. That doesn't make any sense. I understand that most of the cases are annexation cases, but it makes no sense whatsoever to only apply that rule in the context of annexations. With respect to, that's all my time, unless the court has any questions.
I will sit down. Thank you both for your excellent arguments and good briefs. Really appreciate it. And your case is submitted, and you're excused.
Thank you.